Thanks to God.
There is this thing.
Do you realize
consciousness is affected. There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 10 days into the month of March. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, we have clips from various episodes that occurred over the past year. Also, we have information on our upcoming funding drive. All that and more right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. You're listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you would like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at ckut.ca.
Vaccination against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID-vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. Before today's show, we just want to share some information on this year's funding drive. This year's funding drive occurs from March 18th to 28th and is all about sowing the seeds of grassroots change. Since we're a community-based radio station, we require contributions from community members and generous donors. Donations from Support Us helps power all of the content that we create. If you're interested in donating, you can donate online at ckut.ca, mail a check to CKUT at 3647 Rue University in Montreal, or you can call 514-448-4013 in order to donate over the phone during the funding drive. Donations from people like you help CKUT remain the number one best radio station in Cult Montreal's Best of Montreal. Gifts from pledge levels this year includes entries to the grand prize entry draw, t-shirts, bags, and more. Now, onto our main show. In order to highlight the work that we did during the pandemic, upon the one-year anniversary of the lockdown, we're sharing clips from episodes that we did in 2020 and 2021. Up first is an episode that aired in August 2020 that features Amy Lute on her recent poetry book. That's up now.
A shift from, as you said, like angry disabled people sort of like leading the front line in like accessibility work, and then in his opinion, like a lot of organizations are run by non-disabled people, because he suggested that like disabled people have less barriers, so they're just like out doing whatever it is that they want to do. And it was really interesting for me, because it's true that I, you know, like probably in Vancouver, a certain portion of like the disabled demographic is out and doing what they want, because like a lot of things are more accessible, but also that's sort of like a middle class experience for sure. Because yeah, if you're working class or just like struggling with money, that ain't it, right? And so that was one side of it where I was kind of like, okay, wow, that's not an experience that related to me at the time. And then also there's a huge frustration I have with disability organizations that are led by non-disabled people. Like, I just don't think that that's a practical type of leadership, because if you have like lived experience of something, you just have a deeper knowledge of it. And so I personally think that like organizations should be run by the people that are sort of supposedly benefiting from them. And then also like just from like a work perspective, it's like if all these organizations are run by like administrators who don't have those experiences, like it's just like a lost work opportunity too for like a lot of disabled people who are just as qualified, right? If not more. So that's sort of how it came in. And it's interesting because like this poem, it's called Crypt Ancestors. And I was kind of drawing on like something that Leroy Moore, who's Bay Area disability writer, activist, artist, you know, like has articulated a lot in terms of Crip Ancestors. He's got a book by that title as well, or I think it's Disabled Ancestors. But so I was sort of like exploring what that meant for me through the poem. So I was like looking at who were the people who made the curb cuts that I now just like easily roll down, or who were the ancestors who thought up beeping buttons so that people who are blind can cross the street easily and stuff. And so I was just sort of like playing with that idea. But I was also like, I wanted to include multiple voices in the poem. So that's why I included sections of my conversation with Sam Sullivan as well, because he and I, we have like quite different opinions on some things, but I wanted us to be in the same poem, because like you mentioned, Zoe, like disability is such a vast like umbrella term. The more voices in the thing, the better. So that's why I decided to have like quotes and sections of conversations with people in the poem and throughout the book as well.
Sam Sullivan is one of these kind of recurring characters in the book, and you include another quote by him. Is there like other instances of other repeated conversations from different people in the book, and how is that impacting the greater narrative?
The like opening quote is by Lynn Gale, and she's an Anishinaabe writer whose book Claiming Anishinaabe really influenced my writing as well, because her style was just like really conversational, like her style of writing. And her book is all about like determining her own identity and belonging, I guess, in her community, which is very different than mine. But I just really resonated with her, and she was really gracious, and I had an awesome interview with her for the project as well. So she definitely plays in a lot to the book as well, not only in terms of like quotations, but also in the way that I was thinking about access and how like I move through different accessibility circles as a settler, and just how I move through Canada as a settler and have a lot of access. Even if I have like mobility barriers, I still have a lot of access just because of white privilege and settler privilege and stuff. And so, yeah, she, you know, she's like one of my heroes, to be honest. She definitely played in. And also like the poem, which is called I Have Heard, I wrote it after I did this sound walk with my friend Helena Crowbath and one of her collaborators out in Vancouver too. And they did this really cool project where they walked through part of East Van and like encouraged people to close their eyes at certain parts and do like funny things like walk past this little community garden, put out your hand and close your eyes. And yeah, the project was called Meet Me in Listening. And so the idea was to like listen to the soundscape of where you live as a way to connect with it. And so that experience really influenced the piece, which is called I Have Heard For Sure.
And going back to the poem about Crip ancestry, how do you feel the concept of ancestry has impacted that particular poem, and how we can use our ancestors' knowledge, for example, to influence our way of dealing with certain experiences, especially in regards to a disability context?
I think that disability history and disability activism history is really important, because a lot of experiences that we might have could make us feel alone. And so I feel strongly that, having other disabled friends, and then also, that people came before us and were, looking out for us, basically, is a really healing notion. You know, often, people in the 60s who were advocating for deinstitutionalization, for example, they might have known it's not going to happen in their generation, but they're like, okay, we don't want this to be the case for future Crips. And so that's really beautiful thing. I want to learn more too about our history. There's some awesome people, Laurence Perron has done a really awesome job of documenting disability history in Quebec specifically, and there's some other folks too just throughout our sort of context in North America. But I think it's really important, and I think it's cool too, to know even the way that old mobility aids looked, or other tools, it's just cool, from a style perspective too, to be wow, the dudes in the 70s were rocking that stuff, you know? So it's just fun, but also feels important to know about our history.
So leaning back into the idea, disabled people leading disability organizations, and how abled people sometimes co-opt that narrative, how do you feel that art made by disabled people, like poetry, is different when it is self-written versus when abled people co-opt a disability narrative, for example, writing a character with a disability?
I think often disabled characters are written pretty two-dimensionally, mm-hmm. because they often in fiction or stories or even journalism, they often serve to act as metaphors for suffering or for having a hard time or for being inspirational or what have you. They're often used as a literary technique rather than described and shown as real characters in and of themselves. And when disabled characters are written by disabled people, that just doesn't happen, in my opinion, because they're not writing for a disabled experience necessarily. They're writing a whole person. So I think it's super crucial. And I love reading disability literature. It's very pleasing to me. And it's very cool to learn about other experiences that I don't have, or to think about things in a new way. And I mean, that's the awesome thing about reading, is that can enter someone else's world, but it has to be an authentic world. Otherwise, you're just kind of voyeuristic, right?
How did you use your own personal experiences? Because some of the, a lot of the poems are based on personal experiences, in order to craft some of the poems in this book.
I was just being really honest with myself. I wrote them for myself to figure some things out. I was really grappling with how does colonialism play into accessibility? How does accessibility play into colonialism? And so I was just trying to learn and write through learning. And so for me, that's often just personal writing. So I also learned that through writing this and also doing the research that accompanied it, that in order to learn more about that topic, I had to learn more about my own history and my own ancestry in terms of being,
The Prison Radio Show is a twice monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us Collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviera de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. Did you know that CKUT receives no corporate funding? This is fantastic because it means that the station is not controlled or influenced by any commercial interests. Station revenue comes from membership fees, our annual funding drive, and advertising that we do for local and grassroots initiatives. In order to keep the station going, we require donations from listeners like you. Our annual funding drive is coming up from March 18th to 28th. If you would like to make a donation in order to keep CKUT going, you can do so at ckut.ca or by calling 514-448-4013 during the funding drive in order to speak to a staff member and make a donation. Up next is an excerpt from an interview with Raplik member on Jonathan Marchand's protest at the Assemblée Générale in Quebec in summer of 2020. That's up now.
It came to a point where people that needed heavy cares, 24 hours, 7 a day, they could not stay in hospitals, of course. Some of them could not live at home because their problems were too heavy to manage on a daily basis. So slowly but surely, people were integrated into CHSLDs, and it went on and on and on, and we are here today. Today, there's about 3% of the handicapped persons that are under 65. Is it 3% or 2% in this area that live in CHSLDs, which are not an accurate place for them to be in, because you're in an environment, a living environment, that's not compatible to who you are at that age. It's not a very place to be stimulated for a living or for working and whatever. And if you add to that you're not really free to go in or go out whenever you want, it's an additional pressure and deception. When you have all your head, all your judgment, you can speak your mind, and you're suddenly, you realize that you're really in a cage and dependent of every person around you. It's a heavy burden to bear, and if you're at the wrong place, it makes it even harder.
So you mentioned, as well as Jonathan, that the setup that they had in front of the Assemblée Nationale was described as a cage. Yes. What are the conditions like in long-term care homes?
Well, that's exactly it. That's a cage. You get up at the same time, you get fed at the same time, you get your medication at the same time, you have a brunch at the same time, you have dinner at the same time. It's a very routine place to live in. It's always the same. You have certainly, I don't think we can say that he did, the people there don't receive good cares. I don't think we can say that. But it's very repetitive. And like I said, the most important thing is that you have no control over what your day is going to be like, because it's either always going to be the same. And if you want to go out, you have to ask permission. And it's not always granted. Plus all the other problems that come with being handicapped. We're talking about adapted transport and all the places where you want to go. You have to inquire if they're accessible or not. So it's a series of problems that can, a part of these problems can be settled if you're home. At least you're free to go where you want, when you want. You can make your proper arrangements without even thinking, okay, will I be able to go out if I make all these arrangements for my outing? So it's very tough. It's very lonely. It's very depressing, actually.
And how does the prevalence of young disabled people in seniors' home impact their lives?
When you're not in an environment that is lively, that is very stimulating to one person, it gets to you with time. You need to be stimulated in your life. I mean, we interact. We're here talking. We interact with each other. There's something going on, and it's the same every day of our life where we talk to different people. We interact. It brings color. It brings life. It makes you think. It makes you reflect on issues and sometimes change your minds and stuff like that. When you're 43 and you're stuck with people that have cognitive problems, first of all, sometimes you fear for yourself because you cannot defend yourself. If someone gets a sudden rage and attacks you, it never happened, but it's always in the back of Jonathan's mind and people that are in CHSLDs, you can't defend yourself. Mm-hmm. And also, what do you have as a stimulus to think, to get your daily drive on issues? You have the TV and that's about it. And Jonathan is lucky in a sense that he has a girlfriend, he has friends, but some of them are not so lucky. Some of them have very few family, very few friends, and therefore very few activities. So mm-hmm. Can you just picture yourself at 43 and what kind of life is that? It's not a life. It's not interesting to live in those conditions. And Jonathan has a long life expectancy. So for him, living like that the next 20, 30 years doesn't make sense. And that was one of the main premises of his demonstration.
In your letter of support, you mentioned that there was misinformation being spread by the government about Mr. Marchand and the level of care he was being provided. Could you elaborate on this?
Yes. Well, actually, there is a lot of misinformation, and the government is responsible for a lot of these misinterpretations. We've been asking numbers as far as how much does it cost to have people, if you want to make an average, how much does it cost to have to take care of somebody like Jonathan daily in a CHSLD on a yearly basis? And how much does it cost to have the same kind of home caregivers in a home, in the private place for Jonathan? And it's hard to get to have access to these numbers. They do not come out. The government doesn't give numbers very easily. And so that's one of the causes of the misinterpretation. Some people say it costs $90,000 to the state to have Jonathan in the CHSLD. Some say it's $250,000. Some say it's $125,000-$130,000. The numbers is not official. But we know that if you make the average, I mean, we can all take our calculators and figure it out. We can make an average of the salaries of home caregivers. And we can make an average for all the people that receive home care services at home. And we are sure that we can say that living at home with the same kind of services Jonathan has in the CHSLDs will cost less to the society. We know that for sure. There's no way it can be topper than that. Maybe for Jonathan it would be higher. But if you make an average, you have to take into consideration that a lot of the people that receive home care services, they do not require services 24/7. They require 4 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours daily. And that would be more the average of the services that are given at home to people. So the average, if you take all the people that are institutionalized right now and take them in a co-op the way Jonathan proposes, it's guaranteed that first they will be healthier, they will be happier, and it will cost less to the society.
So as of recording today, August 17th, the government and Jonathan came to an agreement and Jonathan took down the site. The CS has agreed to develop plans to begin the process of moving Marchand from the CHSLD. How do you feel this recent development will impact people in similar situations?
Well, like I said earlier, we certainly are hopeful that this committee that was built around Jonathan's actions has a strong mandate. And by a strong mandate, I mean a mandate to make things happen, because you have two types of committees. You have the committees that have the mandate to make things happen, and you have a committee that has the mandate to study things. And committees that study things, they come up with recommendations, but never a lot of things happen after that. So we hope this committee has a strong mandate to make things happen, to take Jonathan's project and build from there and make it better, make it stronger, and make it more accessible, or make it accessible to more people possible. That would be the impact that Jonathan's actions has led to. To us, it's very important that it leads to that, because a committee that only comes up with recommendations that will lead us to December 31st. They have to make recommendations. And then after that, we start the electoral pre-campaign in 2021, the election in 2022. So nothing much will, I don't expect nothing much to move if it mm-hmm. does not happen fast. So we hope, we are hopeful that this committee has the right mandate and has the right people to get things in motion fast. That's our hope, and that's how it will impact people. Because if we don't get that, I mean, what will be the final outcome of that? Will life be a bit better in CHSLDs? Well, maybe it will be, but you will still be stuck there.
So what does the prevalence of young people with disabilities in these types of homes speak for the greater trend of institutionalized people with disabilities versus creating a community-based care model?
Well, you know, there was a time not that long ago where elderly people were taken care of by their own families. And it made them live longer and wealthier and happier. And I hope those kind of co-ops, if they ever come to life, and when they will come to life, because I'm rather on the optimist side of things, when they come to life, it will change the whole thing. It will change the lives of people that live in co-ops, because first of all, you'll be able to have, just within the co-op, you'll be able to have a social life if you want it with your neighbors, which have, some of them have, might have the same particularities than you have. So it favors more exchanges between residents. So that would be one thing. But also, and there again, and I know I'm repeating myself, but you have to be, you have to have stimulus in life. You have to be able to talk to people that will add color and opinion and actions to your life. And when you don't have that, your life gets very boring. So you want to get away from that as much as possible. The more drive, the more stimulus you have in your life, the more you want to do. It's normal. So you have to have exchange, interaction with people. That's the motor of everything. And when you don't have that, when you're not stimulated, you just kind of, well, let yourself go and go with the flow, and there's nothing to be done. So that's why these co-op models have proven to be economically viable. So now it's time to push it up one note and bring people like Jonathan within a co-op, let them administrate themselves, let them take care of themselves, because nobody knows what's better for them than...
Saturday, March 20th, as CKUT DJ Andy Williams and Never Apart present an afternoon with the goddess of underground hip-hop, Medusa, live and direct from Los Angeles. Medusa is an MC, singer, poet, writer, and professor. Her writing credits include Tupac Shakur's Gridlocked soundtrack, Tina Marie's Mac and Game, and Arrested Development's Spiritualized People. The event starts at noon with a DJ set by Andy Williams, followed by a film screening, and Q&A with Medusa at 2 p.m. Closing off the event will be a set by Basement Soul. Conversation is in English, moderated by Tracy Valkersell, curator at Never Apart. Live on Facebook, Medusa, Saturday, March 20th, noon to 5 p.m. This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Come join me March 20th for the Afternoon Delight series. DJ Andy Williams, live stream, good combo, and some information that you probably don't know.
The
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. Throughout these difficult times, CKUT has remained on the airwaves, and we have a whole lot to celebrate this year. The 2021 CKUT funding drive, Sowing the Seeds of Grassroots Change, kicks off Thursday, March 18th and runs until Sunday, March 28th. But you can make your donation right now. If you wanted to donate to CKUT, and more specifically The Avalanche, you can visit ckut.ca/donate for more information. The Avalanche is the only disability and mental health-focused radio show in the greater Montreal area, so support to CKUT helps keep us going. Also, if you donate to CKUT, you have a chance to receive both gifts and entries to some amazing grand prizes. We want to continue bringing you quality programming with minimal advertising. Even though the show is free to listen to, it runs on volunteer labor, well-used equipment, and administrative upkeep. It costs a lot to run a community radio station, so every year we turn to our listeners for community support. Again, you can head to ckut.ca to help us grow more groundbreaking radio on the dial. For our last segment highlighting the work we did over the COVID-19 pandemic is an excerpt from an interview with members of the YS campaign, which seeks to protest Bill C-7, an amendment on assisted dying. Trigger warning for death and suicide. That's up next.
Time and again throughout history, disabled populations have been both overtly and very covertly targeted for elimination. And what Bill C-7 does is it opens up the door. It fast tracks the ability for people to opt out. So then we're left with an even more urgent question. If the government is going to do this much to allow for us to die, what steps is the federal government going to do to actually enable us to live? Because that is found nowhere within Bill C-7.
Well, and something that, you know, Jeff said about this being about choice and supporting our right to choose, and the word autonomy has been thrown around a lot. And we currently struggle to exercise agency on a daily basis, and not because things are difficult for us physically, but because people in authority and organizations and systems actively prohibit us from accessing education and from accessing employment. And, you know, there are processes in place that make it incredibly difficult to access housing equipment that we need that enables us to be independent, and access to the medication that would, you know, in some cases stabilize people's health conditions. And a lot of it, I think, relates to what Jeff was saying about earlier, about there's a fantasy about what disability is in the minds of people who are non-disabled. And it was crafted by non-disabled people. And it's potent. It's every metaphor in every movie since the beginning of movies, and then storytelling before that. And you know, a thing that comes up about that a lot is how it objectifies our experience so completely that the individual experience, us as people, is completely erased. And, you know, I'll have the experience of meeting somebody who's never really interacted with a disabled person before. All they have is the ideas in their head of what that should look like and what that must mean for me. And the conversation or the interaction will start right off the bat with, oh my God, I could never, you know, like, it's so amazing that you're out, or, you know, it's so good for me to see you here, because if this was me, I could never live this way. I would rather die than live this way. And these are people I don't know that I've not encouraged an interaction with. I'm grabbing my coffee at the Starbucks, or I'm buying some, you know, groceries, and they're having this moment where what they expected disability to look like doesn't match what they're experiencing or seeing of me in public going about my day-to-day life. And instead of that suggesting that they might be wrong about that perception, or that entire idea and fantasy of disability might not apply, they assume that there's something like otherworldly special about me. I mean, people will get on their knees and cry because I have crossed a street by myself. It's not proportional to what I'm actually, like, my actual function in the world. And I think the intensity that people have to the fantasy of disability is part of the issue for us in the bill. And that seems very abstract. I realize that, like, we're talking about a piece of legislation that's very concrete. They want to pass it into a law that amends the criminal code, right? Like, that's significant to me. But I think that the reason why it's been so difficult to have a conversation about it in that environment, in the House of Commons, where that the power is, mm-hmm. is because they're all part of that fantasy. They're using an image of this suffering disabled person that they created, and then they're sharing it amongst each other and don't want to hear that that doesn't actually fit for a large majority of disabled people and their lived experience.
Well, I think to some way, I think Aaron, you're right on there, but I think I've heard this many times and I kind of buy into it now, is our disabilities aren't really what disables us. It's our environment and the people around us. So it's more disabling than anything else. And I see that in so many ways, like employment, education, housing. If you don't give people basic needs, how do you expect them to be productive members of society and live a good life? But if their environment is creating barriers to all these things and they have to fight even though to even get in the door, that's what's disabling. And your life would be pretty freaking shitty if that was the case. Luckily, I don't have that situation. I consider myself maybe privileged, but I've got those supports in place and I have those and I know what my life is, but I see other individuals who do not and have to fight for $25 more a month for something, a high fiber diet, and they get that denied. But what that means to people is huge. Like that could, and it's just, well, you don't need that. So it's our society, I think, in general, who are disabling and not disability itself. Because, yeah, I have a C4 spinal cord injury. I'm paralyzed from the chest down. But I have a damn good life that I want to continue to live and prosper and explore and so it's really heartening that, like Aaron and Jeff, and we've all kind of pushed forward, that it's society that are making these decisions or these assumptions on our behalf. And I'm so glad YRYS campaign really got out there quickly and got feedback from the people who this will affect. Yeah, to sum it up, I think our society is more disabling than our disabilities are. So.
Well, and Kevin, you make a really good point about how much at the mercy our well-being is at some fairly arbitrary decision-making processes. Like not getting access to things that we need means that even when we're very privileged, there's also an edge of vulnerability that, like, if you can't afford to pay for your wheelchair or your medicine or your home support care yourself, the government, who would be tasked with the authority to assess whether or not you qualified for death, are the same people who are assessing whether or not you can get access to those things.
I think a friend of mine summed it up really good, is that when it comes to disability, everyone still uses the medical model.
Yeah.
And it sums it up pretty good, because we're still seen as sick or suffering. It's a medical model, and we're not wanting to be seen as a medical model. But all those programs, whether it's community services or health, are all still under the medical philosophy of, okay, keep these person alive or give them chance to prosper. It's just really unfortunate. I see it a lot within our province here in Nova Scotia, specifically around technology and how it's not seen how technology can give someone so much more independence and access to even knowledge or internet, and that those basic things get denied. So how do you expect someone to live a prosperous and enjoy? Imagine if the internet was not accessible to you or I on a daily basis, just for general connection to our society. You throw COVID-19 on top of that, where everyone's in their house, isolated themselves. You've got a perfect storm for people lining up to die. I don't want to be frank, but you could have a perfect storm where, yeah, people will be shitty and they don't want to live because their life is shitty, not because of their disability, though.
I think that's the real concern here with Bill C-7, is it doesn't consider the precarity of disabled lives. Mm-hmm. It doesn't consider how precarious life can be with disability and the ways in which much of the suffering that we may experience in this world is actually at the hands of the federal government, the provincial government, municipal government, even our own neighbors, right? You know, if we were to lose funding for my electric wheelchair, for instance, or if I were to lose funding for my personal support work, that would fundamentally bankrupt my family. Family would be destitute. And so now I'm left with a choice. Do I continue to live and bankrupt my family, or do I choose death and save my family from the financial burden, from the care burden, That is a horrific decision to ask people to make, but it is exactly the decision that we are setting up disabled people to make. And even more worrisome, the more disabled people that make that decision, the more of us who opt out, the cheaper we suddenly become for those very systems, the federal government, provincial government, municipal government. In many ways, the ableist society benefits from us choosing death. And as we continue to dwindle, it'll be harder and harder to get access to those resources. We're a minority as it is already. And once you start having people make those very difficult choices, those horrific choices that are not based on bodily suffering, that are not based on medical diagnoses, but are purely based because someone in Toronto decided that my ability to elevate my wheelchair to reach a higher shelf was a bonus and not a key part of my life as an independent man, that is a very, very sad state of affairs.
Do you feel that the lens in which this bill was created was primarily based on the medical model versus the social model? So for those who are unaware, the medical model being looking at disability as a flaw within someone and something that needs to be quote unquote corrected, versus the social model, which looks at disability as the society in which it exists in. So society choosing whether to install a ramp or not is in fact the issue rather than someone who needs a ramp. So do you feel that the lens in which this creation and all of the potential consequences were hyper-focused on keeping this surrounding issue in the medical model?
I'm not sure if there was necessarily an overt desire.
I don't think there was any consciousness about either that models of that even exist.
Yeah, I think that really this is a reflection of the way in which, while I would say the activist movements to push out the concept of the social model have been remarkably successful in the last 30 years, that at the end of the day, we still live under the hegemony of the medical model. This is a reflection of our society as opposed to an overt attempt to maintain a status quo.
Yeah, I mean, the wording of the bill very much centers the problem in the body.
Which I think is important to note. For some people, that's accurate.
Yes.
For some people, it is accurate. The issue is that the bill itself and the dialogue, the discourse around the bill presumes that that is the truth for all.
Almost. Yeah.
And it presumes that if you are not suffering from a biological condition, that you therefore are not suffering and wouldn't make this choice.
That's true.
And that is our major concern.
Yeah, it does explicitly state that for the purposes of the bill, mental illness does not qualify as a disability. And therefore, if your suffering is considered to be as a result of mental distress, then you don't qualify. But that all presumes that people with disabilities do not also experience suffering based on mental distress, right? Mm-hmm. That like once we have a physical condition, that is the only reason that there's this inextricable link, you know, that suffering is encoded into disability and you can't separate them. And, you know, the social model, as you described, says that's not actually, it's not innate. It's not inherent in physical disability that we suffer, and that it's so complex. I think the thing is that like human suffering is itself so complex that the idea that it can be compartmentalized to apply in a unique way to a distinct group of people where the fair, ethical, noble, you know, merciful response is a facilitated death is itself philosophically so problematic, because humans experience suffering on a great range regardless of disability, you know? And so this idea that we are in this completely separate category outside of the spectrum of human experience, it won't reduce stigma against disability. It won't increase inclusion. It won't, you know, bring us into the center of the societies and the communities that we're a part of. It's an act of pushing us and marginalizing us further, based on something that we're not claiming for ourselves.
And we need to remember that what this essentially does is it places medical assisted dying within the toolbox of the medical practitioner. So when you are diagnosed now with the disability, this is now essentially a treatment option, so to speak, right? I know we say that it must be about voluntary request. Absolutely. But, you know, it's part of a doctor's job to lay out all of the potential options, whether it's the medications you could try, whether it's the therapeutics, what types of programs you might be able to access. This is now another program. And you have to wonder, you know, particularly for those who have lived their life in what they think to be normalcy, they believe themselves to be normal, which I say with my tongue deeply embedded within my cheek. Those who then collide with disability, who enter the disabled population later in life, it is a very scary thought. How many of these people who have been told their whole life and presumed their whole life that disability is in and of itself a death sentence? You know, it's the $1 million baby movie all over again. Mm-hmm. How many of those individuals, when they're hearing their treatment options, are going to say, you know what, I don't want to do this treatment stuff. This sounds awful. I don't want to deal with this. This is too stressful. It's upsetting. And frankly, there will not be a solution in my lifetime to the quote unquote problem that I have. And therefore I'm going to make this decision. And what we find is that people who acquire a disability, eventually, you know, with time, you develop an understanding that your life was perhaps, it's not the same, it's different, but that life is still meaningful. It can be meaningful, that there are ways to make these things work. But time is a factor there. And that's a real concern here is how many people will then make this decision based on essentially faulty information.
Can I chime in on that one, Jeff? Because I think we've got a person who has an acquired injury, so it's not from birth. I got hurt at 15 years old in a traumatic accident. And I always say, if I rewind it myself 29 years back to that situation, was I suffering at first? You're damn right I was suffering. I mean, I just had a severe spinal cord injury. Breathing was an issue, all the newness of it was. But at that time, if a doctor came before me and said, okay, here's your options, it's what we think your life could look like, or this is what your choice is. But if they had an option to say, okay, you could have a life, but you'll get supported with housing, you'll get supported with employment, you'll get supported with all those things, or you could choose to die because your life will be really shitty. I mean, the way you lay it out on a menu is quite different. And how do you ensure that medical practitioners can even lay out that options? Because right now they can't, because I know for myself, I've had to fight for a lot of those basic things over my 29 years, more than anyone else, but I did. I got through. But I mean, it can all be laid out as a really slippery slope, as I say, especially for those individuals who are new to disability and can be asked that question so early on and after having an accident or being diagnosed with MS being diagnosed with a disability. It's just not the right time to ask.
Well, and I think it's also important to note that there have been studies that have shown doctors are very likely to rate the quality of life of a disabled patient significantly lower than the patient would rate their own quality of life. And on top of that, most disabled people have the experience. I don't know how this works, Kevin, you can speak to this, like through the rehab process, like for an acquired disability, but I know growing up with a disability, doctors were consistently wrong about what I could do, about what was okay for me, about how my body would function. They don't. No. And they do everything in these very controlled and sterile environments. And then I take my body out in the world and I throw it around the mountains and I, you know, crawl through the mud. And I'm, you know, it's a very different experience projecting what possibilities are and, like, you know, what my quality of life will be. And they define it based entirely on what they can see in a very short period of time, and not actually on the feedback from disabled people who are living their lives.
Well, and I think an important distinction, and then I'll let Kevin jump in, is that also a lot of those opinions that are driving medical practitioners is based on medical research. And we are, of course, then like, oh, well, it's it's promoted by research. Of course, it must be true. But of course, much of that research is produced within the medical establishment. And so if you're looking for a certain answer, you will probably find that answer. And so I could agree with Aaron, absolutely. Doctors have tried to kill me off a couple times, told me my death was imminent. And I'm still here, despite. And so
I think that that's a very true thing for a lot of people who have been disabled young, that like our life expectancy, even when the illness or disability we have isn't terminal, is truncated by a social narrative, not actually by medical science. And so many of us have outlived several, this isn't going to last for much longer. This isn't going to last for much longer. And it just sort of, I mean, it's really hard to take the authority of medicine as seriously as it takes itself when you have been written off so many times and then things turned out fine.
I can talk about one of the biggest influences I think that helped me get through my rehab process, I guess, and what's kind of different now, I think. And I can only speak of my process. So this is here in my own personal experience. But what was great back 29 years ago is shortly after I had my accident, I met someone with a similar disability to me, someone who has gone through that transition period, someone who's has experience, has knowledge, you could ask questions to, because those answers are quite a bit different than when you ask doctors or medical professionals who aren't disabled those questions. And fast forward now, and I see a huge gap in those types of supports with funding. Whenever there's a peer support program, it's like, well, what's that going to really do? But I see firsthand when people talk to people, not only do they get more hope maybe, or feel that's not going to be that bad, or get a glimpse that it might be bad, but it's not the end of the world, to the point where it just made all the difference for me. And I think if we can continue to get people talking about disability and not as a scary thing, then those attitudes hopefully will change. But as Jeff said, he's been fighting this for how long? I've been going through these ableism. I just learned what ableism was 2 years ago, but now that I know the definition, I'm more familiar with it. I've lived in an ableist society my whole 29 years. I just wasn't aware of it. And that's quite open and frank, but now I notice those things more. I'm like, wow, I used to just accept that because that's what I thought. And that's kind of weird to say that out loud, but it's the truth. Mm-hmm.
I mean, Kevin, you're touching on something I think that's really a huge factor in the precariousness that Jeff mentioned earlier, which is that we're often very isolated from each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I hear stories of newly injured people, and it was spinal cord injury specifically, because I'm in with that community, and not even knowing what supports are available or not given that information and assuming so many things that the only way you'll be successful is if you have 24-hour care. And the only way you can get that is if you live in a nursing home. If someone told you that and you don't know if there's a choice or there's another alternative, well, that's going to be pretty, pretty depressing, I think. So it's so many things how if you talk to people who live it, first voice, I call it, and this is where the government failed once again, and I work for the provincial government, so I can speak very frankly, is not asking first voice people to make these decisions. It's that simple. Ask the people who it affects. And that can just not go with disability. That can go with any variety of things, Aboriginal, gay, lesbian community. Just ask the people who it affects and you'll get the true answer.
The problem with Bill C-7 is that Bill C-7 really actually should be one of the last measures that the federal government puts into place for disabled people. And instead, it's actually going to be one of the first.
Yeah,
we are implementing this before we've tackled any of these other complex barriers that do lead to legitimate suffering for disabled people on a day-to-day basis. This shouldn't be the first thing we're doing. This should be the last thing we're doing.
And we've heard such heartbreaking stories that have come out of this where cases of people who've gone through with a suicide because they can't get that 2 extra hours of attendant care that they need to live independently in their home. And their only choice is to move 4 hours away from their family to a long-term care institution. Like, these are the choices that people are having to make. And that's the disabling thing with this whole thing. It really comes down to that. Oh, those are just little examples, but it's good to point those out. These are small things to some people's mind, but it's massive in the people who actually live it.
I think something also that Kevin is touching on is that a lot that I think non-disabled people don't quite register is that a lot of the options that we're given or the things that we're told, like, you know, Kevin, you're saying how, like, if somebody just says to you, well, the only option is you need this 24-hour care and you're never going to be able to do these things on your own and et cetera, et cetera. A lot of that comes from non-disabled people making decisions based on what they think will be better for them.
Yeah.
And what will make it easier for them to tolerate us, you know, like wheelchairs that are designed for the comfort of a caretaker or a pusher, and not at all in consideration of how a disabled person might move it around themselves. And, like, you know, and just a lot of interactions that we have where we are moved and positioned and set up based on the preferences, the comfort of the non-disabled people that we'll be interacting with, and to some, like, ridiculously paternalistic degrees, because in some cases they've just assumed a dependency that doesn't exist and then tried to mitigate that dependency, you know, by creating all of these obstacles, even though they weren't going to ever be needed in the first place. Yeah. And so I think when we're already dealing with this constant effort that it takes to exercise agency, you know, this, our autonomy does not come effortlessly. We fight for it on a regular basis, that to then call a bill that funnels us toward death an act of, like, respecting our autonomy, you know, the contradiction of that is, I think, really hard for us to reconcile with and to accept and to trust, you know, that, oh yeah, sure, all of, we're going to, all the safety measures, we're going to make sure there are safety measures. And yeah, we do really believe that it's important that we fund, you know, social supports. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's all, those are all things that they can just say to sound reassuring. This is a bill that's being rushed into law. Mm-hmm. It's not just being talked about. They're really push, like, steamrolling it forward very quickly.
In a world in which not every province or territory in Canada has an accessibility law, those who do have accessibility laws are failing regularly to meet benchmarks for those accessibility laws, in which Canadians lose their access to benefits if they move from one country to another, in which the rules that I have...
There is this thing. Do you realize what is there is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
Welcome back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to a series of highlights of episodes that occurred over the COVID-19 pandemic. That completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6. To stay up to date with Avalanche news, check out our Twitter, at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at avalanchecKUT.ca or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4021, extension 6788, or news at CKUT.ca. Stay tuned for Hersey. That's up next. We'll be right back.
It can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth when you're young at heart? For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind when you're young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you derive out of being alive. And here's the best part, you'll have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.